Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her novel Hideout. Kathleen George is a professor of theater at the University of Pittsburgh, and she is also an acclaimed novelist. Her novels to date are Taken, Fallen, After Image, The Odds, which was a finalist for the prestigious Edgar Award, and most recently, Hideout. Welcome to Prosody, Kathleen.
Thank you.
How about we start out with you reading a little bit from your new book?
All right. I'm going to read a little bit that catches my character, Addie Ward, who's almost 83 years old, alone at night. Addie uses a 100-watt bulb in her bedside lamp for reading. She wishes she could sleep, but there's something pleasant, wonderful about this middle-of-the-night wakefulness. Outside her open window, stars visible, animal and insect life getting on with it, the cool breeze coming in. She plunges into the book again, not sure if she's read this section before. She can't concentrate. She's pretty much got her heartbeat under control, but she can't help thinking about the birthday and other things. Tom Jensen, he's coming in a week or so. His house is just up the road. If her heart gets wonky on her, she can call on him anytime, day or night. On the other hand, there are complications. Tom Jensen fell in love with Addie many years ago. There were the whispered how are yous in the kitchen and the inevitable eye contact. It was both unsettling and exciting. Then they'd had one night of folly 50 years ago when she came up to Sugar Lake early to do the planting and he followed. A chill in the air, a lot of wine, a slough in the marriage, and she'd let him hold her, and that had led to more. They'd made love. The next day she woke up horrified at herself and sorry for what she'd done. Tom was not sorry. He wanted her to leave Archer. He said he was ready to leave Marion. She took long and painful stock. She loved Archer. The Jensens were their friends. Their children were friends. They all met at Sugar Lake every summer. We can't throw our lives away, she told him, and she prevailed. The whispered how are you stopped. They settled back into friendship. But Marion died last year, and Tom is floating. He thinks he's in love with her again. He won't say it, but she can hear it in his voice. After marking her place in the novel with a clean tissue, she goes down to the kitchen where she puts a little water in the electric tea kettle. The boy, Jack, who worked yesterday passing through the house, touched it, pulled out the wire to be sure it actually was electric. I'll bet you've seen one of them before, she said, haven't you? Yeah, when I was little. In England, she guessed. He sounded English. They're a great invention, don't you think? Yeah, not a talker. She pours herself a cup of tea and listens to the sounds of the night.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, Hideout. So, Kathleen, I remember interviewing you when your first novel came out, Taken, because you had a collection of short stories before that. And I remember in reading that there was that you had pulled a lot from your theater background. Marina, who's one of the main characters, has a theater background. She uses those skills to help identify the kidnapper, describe him in that. And I've as the books have gone on, I've still noticed that sensibility, but I'm also noticing that it's shifting a little bit. I think that maybe because of working with detectives in your stories over a period of time that you're kind of blending in other things. So I guess my question is, how has writing detective fiction changed you as a writer? You know, what kind of influence has it had?
I think I have intruded less on the subsequent books after Taken. I had an awfully good time with Taken, letting a lot of authorial lines pop in there. But, you know, somewhat by accident, I started to write only behavior, you know, what apparently Elmore Leonard thinks is really good to do, and to not have much comment beyond behavior and the behavior of characters and what they say. And that means pretty much almost scene writing. And people have praised that. They like that.
Now, is that you're still writing the way you did before and you go back and you pull that material out, or has it just kind of changed the way that you look at how the book unfolds now?
I don't think it's in a very conscious way that it's changed, but I think that as I'm working, I'm much more ready to let the characters live on their own.
Sure. And has kind of working with, you know, detectives in a number of your books, we're kind of seeing the tough sides of life. Has that changed you? And this might sound a little highfalutin, but has it changed you as a person at all? I mean, do you think that kind of working in these worlds has made you rethink things? Are you a little more cautious as you walk down the street? Or is this just kind of still a world that you're creating in your mind and it doesn't really...
The second, I don't think that I'm different and I don't think that I walk down the street differently. I always notice things that might make stories. And I finally found a way to put it to use. But I could walk down the street and see a piece of paper floating with something written on it and think, gee, if that said such and such a thing and somebody found it, and what if they weren't supposed to find, you know, find it, and then a whole story would kind of start going in my mind. And now I have a use for all of that, kind of crazy imagination.
Yeah, I guess I'm also thinking just in terms of the worlds that you're working in. I mean, I know I've read in your acknowledgments that, you know, you do get consultation from police officers and detectives, and that helps you understand that. But, you know, some of the characters, the villains in your book, they're kind of tough folks. And so where does that come from? Do they kind of spring into your head, or do you see snippets on TV or in the newspapers? Like, where do those characters come from?
Newspapers are a source, certainly. When a hardened criminal is on television, either doing the perp walk or in a trial, I think I try to understand how they talk to themselves and what they think they're doing and how alienated they are from the rest of us. And that's an exercise that I would say is made more possible by my theater training, because when I was directing plays one after another, one of my favorite tricks as a director was to take an actor aside and work on the actor's interior monologue that was leading to what they were saying. And many of the times I was directing Shakespeare, and he wrote villains, and they were up to very bad things. And we would work on, you know, how one thought led to another that allowed them to think they could do whatever this horrible thing was. And I use that same pattern, that same skill, as I'm allowing these bad people to threaten other people in my novels.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, Hideout. Kathleen, would you read a bit more for us?
Sure. Speaking of bad people, I've got some brothers in this novel, and they're young. They're 19 and 20, and they live in their truck. They're pretty much alienated from society. The elder brother, Ryan, is very addicted to crack, and they're driving one night on the north side. Ryan is very high. They've been drinking, too, and there's a whiskey bottle in the truck. And I'm going to read a little section about what happens that actually starts everything in this novel. The whiskey bottle in the back is empty, rolling around, making noise. Jack reaches around to the floor behind him to reposition the bottle. Slow down. I feel really bad. I feel sick. Yeah, Ryan swerves again just for the heck of it. Look at that. Jack twists up to see out the front window in the empty streets. A bit of movement two blocks down. Oh, it's a girl walking through the park. She steps rapidly, trying not to look about, braving the night. Let's scare the, you know what? Ryan accelerates, yelling, monster coming, baby, just like he thought. The traffic light turns red, but he keeps going. Jack calls, don't, don't. Give her a good one, Ryan says. She looks at the light, red, thinking she has time, moves forward, changes her mind. Jack says, stop, turn the wheel. He grabs at the wheel, but Ryan swerves, pulling away from him. It's just a sound at first, but then the girl is flying up, up, and to their left. Oh, man. Oh, my God, Jack says. Ryan keeps going as if there are no brakes on the truck. Somewhere to Jack's right, in his peripheral vision, is a man running toward the accident. It'll be okay. You hit. Don't, says Ryan. Don't say anything. They move through glaring streetlights until Ryan stops at a traffic light near the post office where a few other cars appear. When the light turns green, Ryan says, don't ever talk about it. Jack can't think what to do. He claps a hand over his own mouth to keep himself from yelling. The running man will call an ambulance and maybe get the girl fixed up. No, they killed her. It's all over for her and it's all over for them. They're on the run. Nobody in the other cars seems to look their way. Ryan obeys the lights now, but moves on, then loops around and starts back toward the north side. Just when Jack thinks Ryan is going to take the truck to where they park it at night, Ryan says helplessly, I don't know where to go. Jack is startled by the tone. Pull over, I'll drive, he says. Ryan obeys, which in itself is different. Once he's behind the wheel, Jack concentrates on being stone cold sober. He concentrates on the road. Everything looks a little unreal. For a long time, neither one says anything or puts on the radio or the CD player. Jack keeps remembering the sound of the woman's body, the sound that it made, and he keeps seeing her flying through the air. You know where you're going? Ryan asks. Yeah. He gets on the highway going north. Ryan doesn't question him. The silence continues. When they pass the Wexford exit, Ryan mutters dreamily, posh, isn't it, Wexford? And when they pass the Cranberry exit, Ryan says it again, posh. A yellow Hummer comes alongside them, passes them as if to make the point. Tell you one thing, Ryan says, I plan to be rich someday. He's out of his head, just out of his head. Their headlights carve out manicured rolling hillsides fringed with trees in bud. Jack drives for a long time, willing himself the whole time to be steady. They pass one exit after another. Finally, they're in a section of old farms with buildings, mostly barns and sheds, close to the road. Then a sign for Harmony Historic District. Amish people. Celia Opal. Clumps of trees like bouquets. Portersville exit. There is still no light in the sky, but there are clean roads and bright road lights illuminating every sign as if to give them high importance. Slippery Rock University. Grove City College. Westminster College. Smart guys live up this way, Ryan observes. Another college, Teal. One of their mother's husbands taught there. Neil, that joker. Neil from Teal. They remember him all right. Neil was how they ended up in Sugar Lake the first time, 10 years ago. I think I know where you're taking me, says Ryan. Maybe you do. The first dead deer they pass lies on its back. When they pass a second dead deer lying on its side, Ryan says, out of the blue, the guy who helped me, you know, turned Chester on his side. He said that was better. It's called the recovery position. After a few moments, he says, I'm going to say we hit a deer, if anybody ever asks. That old man running toward the accident, it happened so fast. He couldn't have seen the license plate, could he? Crawford County line, then with admiration. You came up here yesterday, right? Yeah. And? Well, old Jensen's place is empty. Man, that's brilliant. It's lucky. We're going to stay there.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her latest novel, Hideout. So I want to talk a little bit more about your villains. You were saying that in your theater training, you had your actors kind of think through what brings them to this point. And, you know, I think that can get someone into the dark side. But I think one of the things that's, you know, kind of hits home the most about your villains is they also have, you're able to bring out a real human side of them as well. So it's not, you know, in the scene you just read, the young woman is very vulnerable, kind of even just by who she is. She's young. We find out she's got a couple kids, you know, just by that circumstance, we feel great sympathy for her. But with these two brothers, they're obviously made a lot of bad choices. They're getting into a lot of trouble, but we also have a certain amount of empathy for them so that as they make these bad choices, we feel, you know, pathos kind of in the old Greek tragedy way, rather than just saying, you know, whatever happens to them is what they get. So I just wanted to, if you could talk a little bit about how you develop that tension within the character, so that we don't cheer for the villain, but we care about them.
Again, you know, I think theater helped with that because in theater, you always train actors to not think negatively, but always positively about what it is they're trying to do and what they're going to. And so I was looking to explain why Ryan does the things he does, scares old ladies and shakes them down for money and that sort of thing. He is desperate to be successful at something. He's terrified of old age. And in fact, he says at one point in the novel, I don't ever want to be old. So vulnerability is terrifying to him. I figured that out as I was writing. I wasn't really thinking about it ahead of time. And his reactions were telling me that he was so afraid of any kind of future in which he wasn't in control that he did some very, very strange things. But also, I had to explain, and I wanted to explain, that it wasn't drugs. I wasn't blaming this on drugs. And I had a section where Jack is looking at his brother Ryan, and he's looking through a window of the house that they break into, and he sees Ryan sort of destroying trees and just out there hurting things. And Jack comes to this startling realization that always Ryan has been that angry. He was an angry baby. He was an angry child. Well, he was an older brother, but he was angry even as a little boy and wanting to hurt things, and that it's not just drugs. It's any kind of excitement that he can get that he needs to keep going.
Yeah. And I think also because you've got the two brothers, and Jack, you know, he's also heading down not a great path, but he's trying to see if there isn't another way to do something, but also by seeing the relationship between them. I mean, I think a lot of times we're presented villains who are almost completely outside of society, right? They're the loners. They have no relationships whatsoever. And that's one of the things I think you do really well in the book and have done throughout your books is even the people who are complicated, they still have relationships that make them human, that make us understand them a little bit.
I'd have to say that if Ryan has a go-to, it's also, he has to love something. He loves Chester. Mm-hmm. His friend Chester, who has that gift of humor. Chester almost dies in this book of a drug overdose, and Ryan is in despair because Chester makes him feel good. Chester's funny. Even Colleen Greer, the detective, finds Chester funny, and she's trying not to laugh, but he's funny, you know.
Right.
And so he has something that he loves. For Jack, it's he discovers or rediscovers that he might actually love rural life, that, you know, looking at trees and birds is something that's doing something to his soul. And he's a city boy. He doesn't have that chance to live a calmer life. They're scrabbling for food most of the time. So they both have go-to things as well as the
right.
things that they're negative about.
Right. It makes them more complex. Kathleen, could you read some more for us?
Sure. This is something a little different. This is something I wrote for my own personal revenge because I had my car towed and it was really expensive to get it out. I think it was $260 altogether. And I had only been trying to entertain friends downtown. So when I saw The Pound, I thought, this place has got to make it into a book. So in this book, a gray truck is towed to the pound, and the man who saw the accident says it was a gray truck that did it. And so two detectives, Artie Dolan and Colleen Greer, have to go to the pound on an off day to check out the truck. So they knock, they wait. An officer on duty knows to expect them, but he opens the door to them only after a long bout of fumbling. About a dozen sheets of 8.5 by 11 paper line the walls of the tiny room. Those pages are not exactly yellow, but they're dirty, and the tape holding them up is yellow and cracked. A little thrill goes through Colleen. This is perfection of a sort. The answer is to whatever you are asking or hoping for, no. The wall sign says closed, Saturday after 12, closed Sunday. No cell phones. No evening hours. The window sign says, no change given, no checks accepted. The interior door sign says, no admittance at any time, no public restrooms. Another wall says, payphone at end of ramp, but handwritten underneath it in pen is, it don't work. And on the wall, someone has printed a large obscenity, and someone else has filled in all the spaces on the letters so that it's just one giant doodle graffiti, and the curse isn't immediately apparent. This place is fantastic, Colleen says. Dolan looks at her as if she's lost her mind. The officer is slithering through the door, the no admittance door. A moment later, he appears behind the smeared glass window that's flanked by the signs. The gray truck, the one pulled from Brighton, we need to look at it, Dolan calls after him. The officer studies a piece of paper for a long, long time. Learning to read, Dolan mouths. Meet me down at the gate, the guy says. Make sure the door locks behind you. They descend the steep ramp, knees bent like skiers, and Dolan exclaims, I don't know why you're calling this place fantastic. It just is, pure. Some days I don't get you, he says. I know, Greer answers.
So I have to ask, did you pull out a notebook and start writing down all the signs you saw on the wall, or were those you kind of making up the signs?
No, I did pull out a notebook and I wrote them down because they were just wonderful. And you can hear me and Colleen saying, you know, is there ever a place that's so purely negative? It's like, we hate you, whoever you are. We are going to take all your money, and we're not going to be nice, no matter what you need.
I know. It's just the refrain as you were reading it, no. Everything is no.
Right.
One of the other questions I had, because between your books, you have recurring characters. Some kind of come more center stage than others. Colleen Greer has been in a couple of the novels. And so as you know them over time, I guess I'm asking that is how that feels as a writer. I'm wondering if there are ever times where they get themselves into a dangerous situation, and because you've known them for a while, you feel nervous for them, or if there are certain flaws that they might have that you're, you know, in a certain way, it kind of would become like after you've known a friend for a while, you have a different kind of sense of them. So I just wanted to ask you about that.
I feel like I really know these characters, the recurring ones. Some of them have a little bit more type to them. Like Artie Dolan is great at getting confessions out of people. He loves to eat. But then I had to pair him with Colleen, and I discovered that he was jealous, that she was getting so much attention from Christy, and he'd been Christy's partner, and he didn't like that, you know? So I didn't know that he was going to go that way and get jealous until I actually started writing their scenes. And so he's disappearing on her in this. He's not always there when she needs him.
Right.
And another thing is that Colleen had this sort of major crush on Christy, and she understood that it was a crush, and he's married, and she tried to put a lid on it. But he felt the waves of adoration coming at him, and he tried to say, well, of course, you know, it's like daughter to father, and I'm definitely not going to be affected by that. But he could tell himself that. But he kept thinking about her, because who doesn't like to be adored, you know?
Sure.
So that's definitely complicated their relationships. And I find that fun to do, just to figure out what might happen next between all of them.
Sure. And then when you're writing the piece, I'm guessing you have to figure out like how much backstory, in a sense, you have to do from piece to piece, because some people might not have read the characters all the way through. So you have to give them some kind of sense of what's going on. And do you do that just on its own edit? Or do you kind of keep the file cabinet in your head?
I don't do it as a regular thing. I guess it's kind of hard to fit in backstory when you are moving forward with something that's thrilling, you know?
Sure.
And so only if somebody tells me, oh, I don't understand who this person is, do I find some way to wind it in.
Sure. Because, you know, I noticed that in this book that there is still that residual kind of thinking about when she had kind of more of a crush on him kind of thing. And I knew that was in one of the previous books. And so it's really kind of like how a reader, I thought you did that really well. Just kind of, you know, you get a sense that these characters live beyond each novel, that they're, I don't know what they're doing in their off time when you're not writing about them, but you get a sense they're hanging out somewhere.
They might be eating.
they're eating.
Going to restaurants.
They're on stakeout somewhere or something like that. Yeah. Would you read another short piece for us?
Sure. Let me see what would be good here. Okay. This is once Jack and Ryan are actually in that house, the Jensen house. In the shower, using Jensen's sudsy shampoo, Jack examined a gash on his forearm that he got yesterday fixing the old lady's roof. She'd made him sit down, and she put antibiotic on his arm and bandaged it up. She said she used to work for a doctor. When he left her, he took off the bandage because he didn't want his brother asking where he got such a professional job. He kept his jacket on most of the time, and Ryan was too wasted to notice. He could see yard and woods out the bathroom window while he showered. He wished he could just stay here. The old lady told him she'd bought her place for only $6,500, but she explained it was a long, long time ago, and she and her husband did all the work themselves. He was going to have to go back to her. He put on a plaid robe he found on the back of the bathroom door, gathered his laundry, and instructed Ryan to hand over his clothes and take a shower. By the time he got up from the basement, another thing he liked about this place was the washing machine and dryer, figuring out how they worked and all that, he found Ryan wearing a woman's robe and sitting with a tall glass and a bottle of whiskey. The glass was about half full. "Where did you get that?" Jack asked. Ryan opened a cabinet built into one of the bookcases. He said, "Look what I found. We're in business. Booze, a bottle and a half, and another couple of ounces." Jack said, "It might be better to stay away from it for a while." Ryan looked at him blankly. "I mean, that's not going to last long." "Well, then we'll need more. Drink a drinky yourself. Make yourself more human." Ryan sounded like their mother. She used to say, "Have yourself a glass of mead for any kind of liquor." Jack went through to the kitchen and got himself a glass. While he was in the kitchen, he started a pot of water boiling. He figured he could boil the little bit of spaghetti there was for supper, use the chili sauce in a can to put on it. Ryan was staring at him as he came back into the living room, carrying the empty glass. "What took you so long?" "You know, planning a nice dinner," Ryan laughed. "That's why I like you, bro. You're my little woman, my wife. Take good care of me." Jack poured himself two fingers. "That's it? Modest portions? Conserving. Oh, good little wife." He felt himself getting red with anger, but he just sat in the chair opposite his brother and drank down his whiskey in a couple of gulps. The buzz in his arms and legs felt good, like sleep, and it would have been nice, except he had too many things he needed to figure out. 7:30, Ryan said. "So, way past dinner time." "Wish Chester was here," Ryan said. "That'd be a good time." Jack went into the kitchen and checked the water, which was not yet boiling. He heard movement and saw Ryan climbing the stairs to the second floor. He thought he heard him going to the third floor, attic. There was a bit of daylight yet. They decided not to use any of the electric lights at night. He gathered what there was of plain spaghetti and seashell pasta. Not much. If the sauce was no good, they could eat the noodles plain. Jack felt his jaw tighten. It was hard not to like Chester, but he hated the way Ryan used Chester against him, to prove he was not enough fun, not tough enough, not... He heard the noise behind him before he turned around. "Looky what I found," Ryan said. He held a rifle in one hand and a box of shells in the other. It was a big, beautiful thing with wooden sides. It had a strap. How hard could it be, huh?
Well, with that, you've left us leaning forward in our seats, Kathleen. So I want to thank you so much for coming to Prosody. And we're going to leave with the character with a gun in his hand and all of us waiting to see what happens next.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 90.5 FM.